welcome to this week's episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Fight for Your Life. To arms. I'm not threatening to take your life unless you fight for it. No, that's the Grim Reaper's job. Also, how would I do that from recording on this microphone? I don't think so. But yes, this week's episode is entitled Fight for Your Life. We're kind of looking at films, I suppose, that explore this interplay between combat. They've got a lot of imagery of combat and one's mortality, having to sort of take on the challenge that reality, I suppose, poses or dangles in front of us, taunts us with, to say, you know, to what extent are you willing to fight for your life, to fight for the things that you care about and who you are on a deeper level rather than just for a matter of survival. And all of the films we're going to be talking about use World War II as a backdrop to kind of explore these ideas, which makes sense because World War II was a time of mass death. You know, we kind of horrified ourselves by the sight of what we can do to each other. And I suppose it kind of reminded people at that time, I mean, World War I only happened a few decades earlier, but reminded people that human beings are capable, or, you know, our mortal end can be at the hands of, you know, not just diseases or the natural world or growing older, but at the hands of each other. If you cause enough trouble with another group, or you become enough of their enemy, you'll die at their hands. We can kill each other, and in very horrific and large scale ways. So this is kind of the ideas that we're talking about. How does one survive in this world and avoid an early grave? And I think another, there's a bit of a behind enemy lines, not the film itself, but if not fraternizing with the enemy, but being in the enemy's territory, and how do you get out of that? There's a bit of that about a lot of these films we're going to be talking about this week, but I think it's going to make a lot more sense to talk about the films that were actually talk about the films themselves to sort of make the broader insights. And I think there's also a nice little follow-on from last week's episode. If you haven't caught it, jump onto the 2XX website to listen to that. If you wanted to re-listen to that one, we talked about Life is Beautiful and Shutter Island, and then they explore some fairly existential ideas using World War II as a lens. I suppose this week we're not so much trying to talk about World War II itself, which we've done on the show before in an episode we did, and it was one of the first episodes we ever did on this show, was about, you know, using films about World War II to learn about World War II. This, I guess, is kind of the reverse. This is where we're using films about World War II to learn and use the imagery and the motifs and the cinematic symbols of World War II movies to learn more about how we deal with some of these more existential questions. But the first film we're going to talk about is a Powell and Pressburger film from 1946, A Matter of Life and Death, which I found out very recently is, I think, it's Tilda Swinton's favorite movie. So if you're a fan of Miss Swinton, you might like that one. We're then going to move on to Terrence Malick's 2019 film, A Hidden Life. And then we're going to finish off with a new film from that I recently saw, directed by James Hawes. So it came out, I guess it's technically a 2023 film, but only just came out here. Called One Life, starring Anthony Hopkins, which tells the story of Nicholas Winton, who's a famous historic British figure. But let's start off now, with A Matter of Loaf and... No, that's the Wallace and Gromit film. A Matter of Life and Death by Powell and Pressburger. So if you've not seen this one, it stars David Niven and Kim Hunter. David Niven plays Peter, who is a British Air Force pilot in World War II that gets shot down. And on his way down, he realizes he's going to die, and he sort of radios in to let report back to base what's going on. And he gets hooked up with Kim Hunter's character June, and she's American, and they fall in love over the radio. But then he doesn't actually die. There's a mix up in heaven. Well, it's not actually strictly heaven. It's some kind of like heavenly divine realm. It's one of the early depictions of fantasy. In sort of mainstream cinema. I mean, there's stuff going on a few decades before this, but it's often considered sort of like a pretty innovative film for sort of having some pretty big sets that have kind of like a fantastical element to them. And he's kind of haunted by this benevolent French angel character that comes down. He's like, oh, you know, we have to take you up to heaven. You've died now. And the whole film kind of pivots on the main plot point is, you know, can he argue his case to stay on Earth, to stay with June, his beloved June? So on a very basic level, you know, this is a film from 1946. So it's everyone's coming to terms with the fallout of what we mentioned before was, you know, the most deadly event in human history. And so things like survivor's guilt are running rampant in society. And this is certainly a film that explores ideas like that. You know, why did I not die during a pretty deadly event, and how do I go on living my life knowing that I should be dead right now, or friends of mine are dead, or what you know, how am I supposed to live for the rest of my life knowing that this is all borrowed time, and why me, and that kind of element to it. But I think in talking about this film and kind of getting into those sort of deeper mental health elements of it, I don't want to say necessarily like because I think mental health is kind of like the phrase we use now. I mean, I guess in the past when I said something like psychology or psychiatry, the psychiatric or the psychological ones, but I think it's kind of nice to make that connection to sort of the modern day lexicon. But I think if we sort of look into the mental health side of things and how this guy sort of like deals with his problems in life, in this world, in this film, I think we can kind of uncover this deeper layer of the film that I think it maybe gives it a little bit more modern application. And I think what with him having to make his case, he literally has to sort of make a case like in a court up in heaven to sort of prove why he should stay on Earth. And so what this film does is it analogizes the choice to live on, right? Or better put, to live the way you want to live, or to live the certain way, or to live the right way, or I suppose to live the ideal way or the healthy way. It analogizes that choice to do that, as opposed to, you know, spiral into nihilism or depression or something like that. It analogizes that decision, that choice to do so, to a cosmic trial, to this divine trial. It's almost to say that, you know, sort of our condition is to prove why we should continue to go on and in the way that we intend to go on. And when I say prove, when I say that, you know, our condition is to prove that, well, the obvious question is to whom? And obviously, you know, in the film, there are separate characters that aren't Peter. But as we talk about a lot on the show, I think it's, you know, when we watch something like a film, it's important to sort of see the characters not only as individual characters, but it's also worth looking at the lens where they're all aspects of the same self. And so you can watch this film where he's trying to prove to himself, he's going to a trial that he's adjudicating himself. And you can see, and we're going to talk about another character in a second, but I think it does sort of pose that question where it can serve us in posing a question, which is like, how does one prove to themselves that they should go on despite living through horror and understanding that the world is a very dark and horrible place? And this brings us to the psychiatrist character, Dr. Reeves, in the film. That's why I kind of mentioned the sort of mental health side of things, because he has this kind of social worker helper guy who's a psychiatrist, but he kind of helps him out, and he kind of stays at his house, and he's the whole time he's sort of looking after him. And it's interesting that the psychiatrist character, who we can consider an iteration of Peter's own sort of self-care, the psychiatrist character undergoes somewhat of a transformation himself. So he treats all of Peter's hallucinations quite seriously and understands that this hallucination of seeing the French guy and having this trial up in heaven and all that sort of thing, he sort of treats it seriously because he understands sort of like the metaphorical significance of it and what it really is. You know, and we can treat the whole thing as a hallucination or a fantasy. The film works both ways. And symbolically, in the plot, the psychiatrist actually himself transcends from the physical world into this cosmic spiritual one. But there's a metaphorical aspect to that, which is that those that mend us, whether that's an actual physical professional psychologist or an aspect of the self that looks after us, the aspect of self-care that we all have in our own psyche, we do have to transcend the physical into like a spiritual, into like an imagined or spiritual or an abstract world to understand how the brain should work. We have to engage in some kind of philosophical inquiry in order to pull ourselves out of the darkness. So I think there's some really beautiful symbolism in this film of a very scientific man actually having to go into the abstract realm to rescue this guy and to state his case. And in the real world, he's this psychiatrist, but when he's in the spiritual world, he's actually a lawyer for Peter. So as to say that psychiatrists are kind of like our spiritual lawyers. They defend us against the parts of ourselves that deny us our potential or deny us our future or our ambitions or our positive fate, you could say. And it's probably worth saying as an audience member, that's something that we when we recognize that happening in the film, we like it. We like the idea that Peter is being defended. And we like that he has this ambition of living on in a good way, something that human beings are instinctively happy about. So I suppose at this part of the conversation, I think this film kind of lifts up this idea that it's tough to choose the kind of life that we want to live. It's like a trial to have to make that decision and adjudicate the right path to take. But let's say, like, we take on that challenge. We give ourselves a life path, despite the horrors we've lived through. We pick ourselves up and we pick a life to walk down. Is it always easy just to carry on from there? What happens from there? Well, let's move on now to our second film. Before we do, just remind you are listening to 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host here on Sacred Cinema. For the remainder of this half hour slot, and stay tuned afterwards for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, and also jump onto our website to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. We would appreciate all of that. We very much appreciate you fighting for us in that sense. But moving on now to Terrence Malick's 2019 film, A Hidden Life. And basically, this tells the story of a couple who are living in the Austrian countryside, the picturesque Austrian countryside at the beginning. It's almost like an adult version of The Sound of Music, you could say. And the hills are alive with the Nazis coming in and rounding up the young men to get them to fight for the war, fight in the war effort. And we've got this protagonist who decides that he's going to object. He doesn't want to go and fight in a war. And it doesn't get too much in the details of his philosophy, but I don't think it needs to, because, you know, it's easy for us to latch on to that plot point from, you know, in the context of the 21st century. His name is Franz, by the way. And he, I think it's a really good choice for Malick, where, I'm going to sort of understate sort of the main point I'm trying to make here, so I might skip over that just for a second, but basically there's a real struggle for him to be able to do that, obviously, because everybody wants him to go fight for their country, go fight for the cause, and essentially the premise of the film is the difficulty that he endures in objecting to fighting for the Nazis as an Austrian. And I suppose the underlying point I want to make, at least at this point in the conversation, is how well this film, it depicts this idea of the tragic pains that one endures by living virtuously. So if we are to adhere to classic virtues of, you know, peace and compassion and not fighting in a war for the Nazis, it's not so easy to do that. Like, we might choose this path, but actually acting it out is very difficult. It's quite tragic and painful. So in contrast, I suppose, to the life and death, a matter of life and death, it's not so much that the fight of our life is choosing the right life, but actually living out that life. We can't just put all our focus into designing and making a framework and sort of giving ourselves the challenge of living a good life, as much as a trial that is. The fight of our life is actually living out that life and actually putting one foot in front of the other and walking the walk, not just talking the talk, so to speak. I think there's three aspects of this film that are really important to note in terms of how painful and how tragic it is to live out that virtuous life. So the first aspect, I think, is how the film depicts a kind of relentless assurance of pain in all this. So there's a lot of imagery of hard work and tumultuous sort of effort, and it's interesting how it juxtaposes the difference between nurturing, because they work as farmers, you know, nurturing a farm and raising a farm and seeing that as it's a kind of benevolent pain, but then what he's put in prison for objecting, it looks horrible and disgusting and that sort of thing. And also everyone in the town being horrible to them is quite a, you know, it's obnoxious and it's a hard watch. I think that's kind of like the service level aspect of this. On another level, we've got this depiction of the tragedy of sacrifice, and you could really draw a connection, I think, with this film to the Scorsese film Silence with Andrew Garfield, which we've talked about on the show. But there is an inherent silence when someone defies an oppressive regime, there's an inherent silence to that, because obviously the oppressive regime is always going to dampen the defiance. It's going to dampen the efforts of those that are defying their control and their authority. Hence why the film is called A Hidden Life, because it's not like these people were celebrated during the Third Reich. You know, no, they didn't. It's not like Hitler was telling everybody about all these people that were objecting, and hence why very few people did, because it's very hard to do that. And there's a wonderful George Eliot quote in the film, and wasn't he great, old George? I think distilling all that idea of the tragedy of sacrifice, the inherent silence of defiance. Well, I guess what I'm trying to get out there is that when it comes to pure sacrifice, we've talked about this on the show a lot, that the most fundamental tragedy of sacrifice is that you get nothing in return, right? That the less you get in return for doing a good act, kind of the better it is, but the more sacrificial it is. A true sacrifice isn't, you know, going to work and doing a hard day's work and then getting a big paycheck at the end of the day. A true sacrifice is doing the right thing, doing something that's really hard and difficult and getting nothing in return. That's what true sacrifice looks like. Not being celebrated, not having a legacy, knowing that no one's going to notice it. And this is something that the guards at the prison used to kind of torture him a little bit more, is to say, like, no one's going to hear about this. You're going to be a drop in the ocean. You're going to be you're going to be a blip in the annals of history. And the third aspect of that, which leads really nicely on from that point, is the temptations that illusions pose, these temptations when someone's really in the thick of defying an oppressive regime, that there's all kinds of mirages and illusions that tempt us to pull ourselves away from, to pull ourselves away from the cause. I think the best way that this is depicted is through Malick and Malick's direction, but also the cinematography from Jorg Widmer, where, you know, this is a Malick film where we're seeing the most beautiful depictions of landscapes and big wide shots of the Austrian Alps and huge green pastures and everything. Like, you could watch this whole film on mute. It's the most gorgeous thing. They should put this on at Harvey Norman just to show off beautiful televisions. I mean, you get this with all Malick films, but this one in particular. I'd never seen this film until it was actually recommended for the show, and I loved it so much. And just looking at it, it actually tempts you as a viewer to want to just throw everything away and go live in Austria and live in the Austrian Alps. But I think there's a theme in this film that we also see in another Malick film, which we've talked about on the show, which was on the other World War II episode we did. We also briefly talked about when we talked about the film Come and See. But a lot of war films have this symbol of the adjacency of peace and war, where you have, you're often in war films, you have this very immediate juxtaposition where in some films the war is a long way away from home. In other films, they make a really big point to make the war, the place of war, the theater of war, and the theater of conflict be very close together. And we see that particularly in something like A Thin Red Line and Come and See. But I guess in the world that he lives in, he can simply just go back to this beautiful village that he's from, France, I'm talking about. It's not so much a visual, it's not the adjacency is depicted visually, but that they keep giving him a contract and they say, if you just sign here, you can go back to your life. And through Malick and Widmer's work, making this place look so idyllic and heavenly, as an audience member, you're like, oh my, I would go there now anyway. I would throw my phone away, as if this guy living in this horrible, disgusting prison is not just going to throw away his principles and do that. But I think what's also really important here is that it is an illusion. Like, as much as it's a temptation, there is no such thing as the idyllic in the real. Like, the village is still it's still hard yakka. It's still a day's hard work. It's still a muddy place. Franz's wife is still being spat on by the other villagers who you don't really get along with that well. And I think this is probably something a little bit better conveyed in Thin Red Line as well, which we've talked about on the show, the point of, you know, when he deals with, like, the local people and he's like, well, you know, who are these people? How is this different to our lives? And you actually see them wrestling and getting a bit of conflict. And you're like, well, it's not as simple as just saying we should go back to nature and go back to agrarian. The temptation is a false temptation. It's the devil's temptation. It's trying to give you something that on face value looks great. But, you know, what you're really doing, if you're Franz in this case, if you do go back to your village, yes, you can have, you know, nice fresh veggies and everything, but you're giving up your principles. That's a pretty devilish thing to do. It's not really an idyllic place, as tempting as it may appear. And so the ultimate sort of, in, you know, the rub of this film, I suppose, is, and Malick isn't shy about saying this, is he's kind of advocating for a very Christ-like existence, isn't he? When we talk about ideas like the certainty of suffering, the thankless quality of sacrifice, and the you know, the taunting of temptation, these are sort of all of the passages, the rites of passage, and not the stations of the cross as such, but these are all sort of the plot points of Jesus Christ's life, and Malick makes no mistake about how a lot of his, you know, about his films are quite explicitly, you know, Christian films, and so I guess on the whole, what the film is kind of advocating for is that, you know, the grievances of Christ are kind of akin to the kind of grievances that we have to undergo if we want to live a virtuous life. Living a good life is very hard to do. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of grit, and we see this in all three of the films, that sacrifice by either the protagonist or one of their loved ones is like a key and a requirement to being liberated in their respective realms. And this has left us in a difficult place, because when we talked about matter of life and death, we talk about the idea of, you know, we fight so hard to choose the right life. It's a real trial to find the right life to live. But then when we actually have to live that life, it's even harder. That's the actual fight of our life. The first thing was just a warm-up. And we can very often, you know, falsely pour all attention on the planning of the life, the planning of the fight. But when it actually comes to the fight, a lot of people can bail out because it's so much harder than they planned and what they expected. So how should we think about the fight of our life? How should we look at our future and look at the fights ahead of us positively in all this sort of existential territory? Well, let's finish off now with James Hoare's new film, One Life, starring Anthony Hopkins. As I mentioned before, this one follows the achievements of Nicholas Winton, who was a British hero who essentially saved a lot of Jewish children in Prague at the beginning of the Second World War, when Hitler was going through Czechoslovakia and, you know, doing the Holocaust. And Winton was able to get all these kids on the trains, I think it was called like the Kinder Express or the Kinder, there's a special word for the trains that they got the kids on and got them out of there. And a big plot point of this film is him sort of looking back on his life and being like, okay, it was good that I did that, but there's a lot of bad in the world. There was still a lot of bad at that time, and there's still a lot going on now, at least in 1987, which is when the film is kind of set. And I want to finish up this week by kind of emphasizing this idea of the ease with which goodness, sort of everyday goodness, can be amplified to greatness. Through the effect of time passing and entropy, goodness can actually increase and expand to become greatness in the grand scheme of things. So he puts a lot of focus on the number of kids that he brought back, and it's like 600 and something. And he's like, 600 sounds good, but, there's a real tragedy in the fact that only 600 out of the thousands upon thousands of children that died through the Holocaust. It's like, I'm thinking more about the ones that we lost. You know, 600 is good, but it's not really that much in the grand scheme of things. But then as the film progresses, we see this gradual build of recognition of Winton and his, you know, involvement of newspapers and academics, and then the That's Life TV show. Speaking of fighting for one's life and mortality, it's interesting that the show in real life was a show called That's Life, and human beings almost have this like interest in, we can't avoid our interest in mortality, so which is not surprising, but anyway, it's just interesting that that's there. And then he sort of connects with some of the children of the survivors. So it's not that he just survived. It's not just that he saved people, but he saved people who then had children and they had grandchildren. So there's actually a statistic in the film that talks about like saying like he ultimately actually saved something like 6,000 lives because of all of the ancestors that came from the people that saved him. Sorry, that he saved. And then we have the movie we're watching itself and this week's episode about the film, about the man, Nicholas Winton. Which I think leads us to a really important point to sort of finish off on this week, which is the film itself and the process of talking about the man that the film is about sort of becomes part of the story, which is ultimately a story about how big, like a relatively small impact, one man's small actions, how big that those actions can eventually have as they continually amplified through one's legacy, through one's history, through the remainder of their life and history and through their legacy. And so the more that these stories are told, the more that we spread the stories, the more this story continues to inspire, the more the effect of these supposedly small acts at the time get bigger and bigger as time passes, right? And we further that story itself. So I'm very happy to talk about this film and talk about a person like Nicholas Winding, because maybe there's a person out there that doesn't know who he is. And maybe from listening to this episode and watching the film and reading about his story and reading up and after the, you know, reading books about him or something like that, you know, we're all a little bit more informed about the, you know, what we're capable of. And you should watch the film or learn about this guy's story just to realize that how much of a dreamer he was, to realize that, you know, the things that people thought were impossible at the time, you know, saving these children with the trains, it was at the time was something that no one thought they could actually do. And this guy was brave enough and smart enough to realize that there was a way to do that. So how can we wrap up this week? So to begin with, we talked about the fact that when we're sitting there with our lives in front of us, it can be quite daunting to think, you know, life is full of horror. I've lived through a great deal of misery. There's a lot out there that scares me, and there's a lot that scared me, and I don't know how to deal with that. And it's kind of like we're in a trial where we're our own judge. We've got the hammer there, and we're saying, you know what, how are you really going to choose? Why are you worthy of a good life after this? How can you possibly be someone that's worthy of that? And that's a really arduous fight that we have to anyone that's ever had any difficulties with something like nihilism, even if you haven't had tragedy in your past and you haven't lived there. And also, I should mention as well, the Peter character's a bomber. When I recently watched this documentary about how the bombers had to like kill so many civilians and stuff through Germany, like the bombing of civilians is not a new thing in human history. I think there's also like a subtextual element to A Matter of Life and Death where there's a sense of guilt about what he did. And there's like a line there actually where it says something like, someone had to do its dirty work, but someone had to do it anyway. It's a very difficult thing. It's like it's like going to trial. We have to really prove to ourselves why it's worth living a good life. But then once we take that good life on, that's really actually when the real fight starts, actually walking the walk. We shouldn't just point our attention just to the direction of our intentions, but the actual acts of living a good life, that's much more of a battle and can be much more arduous. And can be saying that they can ultimately lead to the ultimate sacrifice in many ways. But perhaps part of why choosing to live a good life and actually going out and living that good life is so hard. Perhaps that's so hard and so hard that it can often be very discouraging. Perhaps that's so hard because in the long run, we actually can make very huge impacts on the world and push it in a much better direction. Even though it seems like all we've done is just have a small couple of little wins, maybe it is the case that we needed these things to compound over time in history and let entropy take its course and let this almost like the interest accumulate on these smaller, these acts that at the time of when we do them feel like only small little drop in the ocean acts of goodness. Because perhaps the fight for the one life that is our life is not all that we're fighting for. That's it for Sacred Cinema this week. Thanks so much for tuning in here on 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio. Stay tuned for more quality radio content here on 2XX, or jump onto our website if you're not there already to consider listen to there and consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. We'd love it if you do that. Also, get in touch with me. Hidden Life is a recommendation. You can make a recommendation yourself by emailing me at contact@jimmybernasconi.com. We'll see you next week. Cheers.